Welcome to the Whiskey and Wisdom Podcast, coming to you from the Cargo District Recording Studios in Wilmington, North Carolina, where we discuss the most fascinating topics of life. I'm Tyler Yaw with my co-host, Chris Kelly, and each week we interview a special guest to learn how they acquired their wisdom over a glass of whiskey. So sit back, pour yourself a glass, and enjoy Whiskey and Wisdom.
Welcome back to the Whiskey and Wisdom Podcast. I'm your co-host, Chris Kellum. I'm here with
Tyler Yaw.
And our guest today is Justin Humphreys. I'm just making up names now.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
It's been a day. I was like, wait, am I just making up a last name or a first name?
So to say, you know, I'm professionally in multiple different ways, right?
Yes. We found it took me long enough to realize that when we bought our house, I was like, oh, I use your law office to do my stuff.
Well, thank you for trusting us with that. It was our pleasure. It's one of the, we've got a residential real estate practice. That's one of the things we enjoy doing.
Yeah.
Nice.
You practice a bunch of different law.
I do civil litigation and real estate are kind of my two main areas. And civil litigation is sort of a broad topic, and it's just essentially, you know, people suing each other,
right?
Is what it is. And it can be over money. It can be over property. It can be, you know, to restrain or to stop people from doing things. So it's kind of there's a lot of different subsets within civil litigation, but kind of the broad category is just referred to as civil litigation.
Nice. Before we dive into that too much, I know we just poured a little bit of whiskey. So Chris, what are we sipping on today?
So we were allowed to taste this amazing Jameson 18 year. Me and Tyler realized, like, we didn't realize they went up this aged. So this one is going to be like more of a spicy toffee on the nose. And then just taste wise should be pretty smooth toffee, some wood flavor, some leather, and a little bit of sherry. And then on the back end, the usual, just some toffee and spice. You know, what usually happens when you get a good Irish whiskey.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's test it out.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. Whoop.
That's smooth. That's very good.
Mm.
It's a very easy Irish whiskey to drink there. Oh, yeah. Makes it easy to go down.
It just surprised me.
Yeah.
Because we've been drinking like more North American whiskeys, and we haven't. It's been a while since we had something from across the pond. So.
Well, it was interesting when you were going through the flavor notes and whatnot, and I don't really know, you know, when I'm hearing that, but kind of one of the recurring things, I tend to like things with a sherry taste.
Okay.
Like the scotch, Macallan's what I like for scotch, and I think it's aged in sherry cask barrels, and that's kind of their thing. And that's about as much whiskey as I know, but I just kind of go with what I like. I tend to like scotches and Irish whiskeys, and I do like bourbon as well.
Mm-hmm. It was always funny how when we first started getting into the Whiskey and Wisdom podcast, people would talk about different scotches and whatnot. I'm like, I don't know. I'm just not really a scotch guy. And everyone's next response was, you're not drinking the right scotch, which was fair.
I agree with that. I mean, there's some like really peaty scotches that I don't care for.
Yeah.
And then I don't really care for a lot of charcoal flavored type stuff. But for the most part, you know, I like Callens, like Glenfiddich, like a lot of those.
Right. What was the one that we had with the guy from True Blue?
Oh.
Lafroig?
Lafroig and Glenmorangie?
Yeah, those are very peaty.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very peaty.
I think, I'm like you, I prefer Macallan.
I got shamed in Liverpool by a bartender for ordering a Glenmorangie on the rocks.
Oh, really?
Glenmorangie is a proper whiskey. Sorry, man. Sorry.
My bad. I would have done the same thing, too. I don't care what it is. I always like it on the rocks.
Yeah. I'm the same way. Like like being cold, little bit white. I mean, I don't like a ton of ice in it, but just changes the feel of it.
Yep. And you have like one solid like rock in there to like slow melt, and it changes the taste over time, which is a little bit nice too.
Yeah. I love those. I got some ice molds that I use every once in a while.
Right. Yeah.
And looked into trying to get a refrigerator that makes them at one
point. Oh, yeah. So that would be so cool.
Just decided it wasn't worth it.
Right.
That was a side hustle I looked at for a little bit because I realized
ice cubes.
Well, yeah. So like in town, because we're getting more and more like cocktail bars. Mm-hmm. They all like that large square shape. The problem is clear. It has to be clear. And so you have to freeze it a certain way. And then half the time, like, cause it's ice, it's near impossible to get perfectly sized. Mm-hmm. And so I'd show up to the bar and then be like, oh, well today it fits. And then I'd order a second drink and the ice cube wouldn't fit properly. And they're like shaving it down. And I was like, I could get into this gig. Cause I think Wilmington only has like one, maybe two people who sells it.
And I'm not too picky about the cloudiness of my ice spheres. Right. I've been to some places where they cut the ice from the larger block because they don't want any imperfections in the cube. I'm like, all right, whatever.
Right.
You're like,
so my palate is not that refined to tell the difference.
No. I think technically it's with more bubbles, it melts faster.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it looks...
When I went to Vegas, they did something like that. They like had a larger cube and they shaved down the cube and they put it in there and it's like, it was a whole thing. And they told me where the water was from and whatnot. I was like, okay.
All right.
It's water.
Right.
I mean, unless it's from Kentucky, I don't care.
I'm heading down there next week.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I'm really excited going for that. I don't have tickets to the Super Bowl. I may end up trying to find score something, but we'll see. They're pretty steep right now, and I'm not really a huge Kansas City or San Francisco fan, it'll be kind of cool just to be in the area when all that's going on.
Yeah, that's neat. Are you going for like a conference or anything, or just going to hang out?
Nah, just going to hang out.
Awesome.
Got some friends that are going down for the weekend. Going to go see a Tom Segura show.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. Forward to that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think it'll be pretty fun.
Yeah, very neat. So a little bit less about the whiskey, a little more about you. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an attorney, kind of practicing real estate and civil litigation. I've been in town for about 17 years.
Okay.
It's kind of flown by.
Yeah.
And I've kind of my career's transitioned. In the beginning, I was doing more insurance defense. And you know, that's essentially most of the time when people get sued, they turn it into their insurance company. And I would defend anything from, you know, your fender bender car accidents to professionals getting sued, like real estate agents or things of that nature, to, you know, we did some work for some of the local municipalities. So if a police officer shot someone, you know, we did a couple of those type of cases where they would say it was excessive force or things of that nature. So it was a wide range to start off with, and did that for the first, I guess, 6 years of my career, and then transitioned into having my own practice in 2013, joined a law school classmate's firm.
Okay.
And he had his own practice since 2009, and he was kind of looking to phase out. He was going to get more into being in-house counsel.
Okay. Yeah.
And so he was kind of on the way out, and he had an opportunity with his firm. So I ended up leaving and joining his practice. And it was nice because it was the freedom of having your own business and law firm, but kind of being eased into having somebody that had done it before, kind of have everything set up, and it wasn't as hard, sharp of a learning curve at all because I was able to kind of phase in that way.
Nice.
So question, is there a difference between an attorney and a lawyer?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you for our sponsor, the Leland Brewing Company, right over the bridge in Leland Township. Definitely check them out. It's a nice local spot with local beers that they're making on site, as well as some that aren't from the area. It is an amazing family-friendly location, and it's really nice. They got some greenery out back, as well as some nice food trucks that pop up every now and then. So give them a check out. Tell them that Whiskey and Wisdom sent you.
I don't think so. You know, in I guess England, what they have, barristers and solicitors.
Yeah,
right.
I think I'm pretty sure it's the same thing as lawyer and attorney. But I know I do admiralty law as well as one of the areas, and that's kind of a subset of civil. People suing each other over incidents on the water. And, you know, that there is a distinction with there to be a proctor. Huh. To be a proctor, if you'd seen that, that's kind of, there's a organization called and there you have to have been a member in good standing for 5 years in order to become a proctor. But as far as an attorney or a lawyer, it's the same thing.
Oh, good to know. I've always wondered that too. I mean, if people use it interchangeably, I'm like, even if there was a difference, it doesn't make much of a difference anymore. Cause now in normal discourse, it's one and the same.
I figured it was like realtor and realtor. I was like, are they?
I've never understood what's the deal with that. And then I think there's brokers, and I think that's a different thing as well. I don't know.
I know there's a difference between being like a real estate agent and a realtor, because an agent just means you can sell a house. If you're a realtor, it means you're actually part of the organization.
Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah. I've seen the trademark logo on Realtor. So
you're right. Yeah. Brittany schooled me on that.
I knew there was a difference. and I had it in the back of my head. I just couldn't remember it off the top of my head.
Yep.
So how did you end up transitioning? Like, was it when you switched to this new law firm? Is that when you kind of were like, we'll switch it up a little bit?
Well, so doing insurance defense is kind of, it's a function of being selected by the insurance company.
Right.
And most of these insurance companies have longstanding relationships with the defense firms that they work with. And, you know, I knew when I was leaving that I was going to be kind of out of the mix as far as insurance firms wanting to hire me. And so I wasn't planning on taking kind of some of my former clients with me to the new firm. So I had to change the nature of what I was doing and being more representing small businesses and private individuals, as opposed to kind of some of the insurance companies that I was doing in that part. And with real estate, that kind of happened because my old partner had a residential real estate practice. We did commercial as well. He had a real estate practice. And so that's kind of how I learned to do that was just from being involved with him and working at the law firm, kind of seeing how they did. Because that wasn't originally part of the plan, but that was just something that I kind of picked up.
Nice,
it was 2013. So it was a lot of change was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of coming out of the big dip and kind of the real estate bust that happened around, you know, from, I guess, 2008 or nine to about 2012. And then there was a big change in the way you had to do your accounting. There was, you know, they changed the form from the HUD to the closing disclosure. Yeah. And I think TRID is the, what they referred, that's the law that changed it. And a lot of people that were in it were kind of getting out. They didn't like doing it. And so to me, it wasn't a big deal because I hadn't been doing it the old way. So it didn't really, just kind of like learning something. So it's just like, okay, this is how, it wasn't as upsetting, or it wasn't a pride. I didn't know how to do it before then anyway. So it was just kind of the way I learned to do it.
So when, with all of the new technology coming into the world now, talking about smart contracts, everyone's talking about how that's going to change the game of real estate attorneys. Do you see any change that could possibly happen there, or?
One change that's very welcome that I think is going to start this July is remote notaries.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I think that'll be nice, because one of the things that we do that can be kind of annoying is mail away closings.
Right.
And so, you know, that's where you get the documents. Everything North Carolina still requires wet signatures on real estate transactions. Mm-hmm. And so you get the package, which, you know, a lot of times it's 100 pages and that says like the same thing over and over and over again. And then you take it and you mail it off to wherever the client's located, and then they go into a bank, or, you know, to maybe they hire a notary, or they do things of that nature, and then they send it back to you. And it's always executed wrong. And then you're probably going to have a problem with your delivery service like UPS or FedEx and that sort of thing. And so it's just kind of all the transactions we do, those are the ones that have the most problems. And, you know, they're vulnerable to fraud as well. One of the things that is kind of going on right now is there's some scams going on where people pretend to be property owners. And then they'll be remote, and they'll say, I don't have time to come to your office. Just ship me the deed, and I'll get it taken care of.
So you
get some of that too. So one of the nice things with the mobile notary is it's just going to be over a computer. You'll have a video of the person signing the document, and, you know, they can use technology to verify the person's identity, you know, through like, what was your middle school mascot, or you answer questions like that. And so, some of those sort of things that can be pretty good. So I think that's something where technology is going to be a big help, at least locally for us. There's a lot of areas, North Carolina, you know, it's a great place to work and live, but there's a lot of areas where it's behind the times.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly in the court. Like, we're one of the few states that doesn't have electronic filings for lawsuits and court documents.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, I don't know if you guys, I've follow a lot of lawyer joke accounts, and mm-hmm. you know, they're kind of ridiculous. But one of them, you know, it's funny. There's that one with Joe Biden in the Corvette, and he's got his aviators on. Yeah. He's like, "Come on, Jack, we're going down to the courthouse to file some documents." and it's like a joke to people in New York and other jurisdictions, even South Carolina. But here it's like, nah, that's what we're going to do. Yeah, yeah. We're driving down to the courthouse to go file some documents. Is what we're doing. So that's North Carolina 2024. But I think that's transitioning as well.
I know a lot of people that have moved into North Carolina who are attorneys from other states, and they said that our bar exam is like ridiculous compared to others because of such antiquated laws that are still on the books.
It is, and it was, but now they use the multi-state bar exam.
Oh, so okay.
Now there's an attorney that works with us that she took the bar a couple years ago. And now there's kind of a more uniform test that's across different jurisdictions. And so the North Carolina is using that now.
Okay.
But yeah, that was the case. There was a lot of North Carolina specific stuff that you had to memorize all the antiquated laws in order to pass. But yeah, that certainly was the case, I think, up until about 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's crazy.
That is. I always laugh because I remember when I was younger seeing something where like there's a teacher and a cop living together, and because you weren't allowed to live with the opposite sex unless you were married, both of them lost their job. And I was like, this is the stupidest thing.
That went down in Brunswick County when I was in law school.
No way.
Yep. So yeah, there was a, I think she worked for EMS,
mm-hmm.
and she was fired for cohabitation. Because North Carolina had an anti-cohabitation law
that's crazy.
On its books. She sued and she won, and the AG or whoever was the state essentially decided not to appeal it because they didn't want the possibility of that law getting overturned. So sitting superior court judge doesn't have the authority to overturn a statute, which mm-hmm. that's what the anti-cohabitation thing was, a statute. Mm-hmm. He can make a ruling that it's unconstitutional in its application, he or she, doesn't have the authority to strike it down. Whereas the appellate courts, if it went up that high, they could say, yeah, that law is coming off the books. You can't do that.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, I was that. I remember that because I was in law school when that happened. It was like 2005, Brunswick County. And at that time, I think I started an ACLU chapter at my law school, and we brought in one of the attorneys that was working on that case to come in and kind of discuss what was going on. And I think we made the new, or not our local ACLU chapter, but I think that case made the news in Canada and like a couple countries, like what is going on in America 2005? Like, how is this a thing? But that happened right across the river.
Oh, wow. That's so crazy.
People always think I make up shit. Like, no, I knew this. The one thing I remember.
I've heard that before, but I thought it was just one of those like, oh, hey, this could possibly happen. I didn't know like it actually did happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of, and I don't know how many of them are true as well, but you hear kind of like rumors of old stuff that's been on the books forever, and that can't really be true. But yeah, that one is true, and it did go down.
Like, there was a random one that I saw somewhere, like, again, I don't know if it's true or not, but in like some random state like Missouri or something, you can't walk an elephant down Main Street. Like, there was something weird like that.
Well, like, that sounds sound. I can get
that. I was like, I can understand that though.
Yeah. I mean, there's one, like, you know, you hear them like, you can't have, but like a maximum of four women living in the same home, you know, like there's something like unrelated and that sort of thing. And I don't know. I mean, I think along that ilk, I think it's crazy that we don't have happy hour in North Carolina.
Right.
That's illegal. I mean, I'll never understand that. And apparently there's like a member of the legislature that brings it up every year, and it always gets shot down. And I'm just thinking, what's the opposition to happy hour?
Right.
How? I mean, I guess there was a time when, you know, like during that a lot of women were upset that their husbands were going to happy hour after, you know, after work. Right. And I think that was the original purpose of banning it back in the, you know, the 20s and 30s and that sort of thing.
Right, but that prohibition era type of thing.
Yeah, but, you know.
That's just funny. Like, I thought the reason was because, like, they didn't want people to overindulge in alcohol and then drive through traffic.
Well, what's funny about it though is, and this is what I bring up all the time too. So you can't have a happy hour, but if that sale is going on, you can do it for that day. Yeah. It's like, okay, so you can day drink cheaply for the whole entire day, but don't do it for 1 hour.
Yeah. Yeah. We do not want people getting a discount to drink earlier in the afternoon. cannot let it happen.
Now, but 11 a.m. A-okay. Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that's part of it too. Is like, we don't want people drinking during rush hour. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, you know, so get them in there at 4, get them out at 7.
Yeah.
It'll be fine. You know, it'll take away some of the traffic, give some people better stuff to do than sit around in their cars during that time.
So I know we've talked about you doing civil litigation. So is there anything that you primarily focus on since it is such a broad kind of spectrum?
Yes. The majority of the civil litigation cases that I take are real estate related, or admiralty related, or sometimes kind of business disputes.
Okay.
Those are kind of the three main areas that I do within civil litigation. Mm. The admiralty stuff's a lot of fun. You know, it's what's cool about it is it's kind of a niche area, and there's kind of a limited group of lawyers that do it. So you're kind of working with the same people every case, and you develop a rapport with them, and it's not as, you know, it's not like Suits or like some of the shows you watch where it's like, you know, sharp elbowed people and going after each other every time. You know, it's, you know, we work hard for our clients, and that's certainly the most important thing. But it's just, you know, you're going to be treated professionally, and that you're going to be working with somebody that knows what they're doing. And that's what I enjoy about that area.
Is there something that comes up more often than not in that world?
Yes. So I was talking to a friend that I work with a lot that does a lot of maritime law. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about how many cases we've had locally that involve somebody letting their kid take out the boat. And that's always when it happens. Like it goes anywhere down from underage kids to adult kids in their 40s, you know, but the majority of the kind of the pleasure boat accident type cases we've had recently have all been somebody's borrowing dad's boat. And it's just, I guess that would be something I'd say is, you know, watch out, you know, letting your kids use your boat, you know, make sure that's covered with your insurance and that they're responsible and that sort of thing, because that is a common theme is wrecking dads. But, and it's not what you would think. I mean, sometimes, you know, it can be anything from skiing or kneeboarding accidents to running aground is something that happens a lot in this area, and
the water moves so quickly here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's understandable. And I'm kind of a rookie boater as well. So like, I gotta be careful what I say. Like I might be the next one, you know, involved in something like that, you know, from hitting submerged docks or sometimes hitting piling, you know, it's tough. And a lot of times boats hitting each other, you know, nighttime driving is a big time thing where you see a lot of it. And what happens in every nighttime collision is they always say, oh, well, the other boater didn't have their lights on. And, you know, and I'm sure that's what the person believed because they didn't see them. I mean, they weren't trying to run them down. But you know, it's sometimes it's hard to distinguish a small light on the bow of somebody's boat from a house along the shore.
Right.
I've always found that really interesting too, is I feel like there's regulations for everything, but the regulation for lights on the back of a boat at night are very small or in front of it. It doesn't matter like where on the boat, but really it's not a lot of light comparatively speaking to like what you think about a car going down like a highway. There's a whole lot more light coming off of that than what you see on a boat.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah.
But you know, having more lights can be a problem.
True.
You know, it's the thing you get, cause you know, you don't want to blind other boaters. You don't want, you know, there's kind of counter objectives that you're trying to go with. But yeah, I mean, it is, you know, I don't, that's another, so that's the thing. Parents letting their kids go out at night with the boat is the recipe for a lawsuit arising.
Yeah. That just sounds like a recipe.
Just in general. There's actually a good friend of mine that was boating at night and got into a really bad accident, got thrown off and had to have a bunch of surgeries and everything like that. It was from running aground at night. And then it just hit it so fast because they were going so fast, threw him out of the boat.
Yeah. So that's the other thing I would say is if you have boats and you like to go, or even if you don't go out at night, get good insurance coverage.
Yeah.
You know, because that's one thing. And it's relatively cheap for boats as well. Really? So compared to cars, liability coverage. Like, you know, I've got a little small 21-foot boat, and I've got $1 million in coverage. Mm-hmm. Just because stuff that happens on the water tends to be worse than, you know, the boats right. don't have the safety features that your yeah. car does. And, you know, and that's what can happen. You know, you run aground, somebody's getting ejected, and, or, you know, yeah. you got, they might get hit yeah. by a prop, or, you know, who knows what's going to happen. So that's definitely something I would say is, like, as far as value, liability boat coverage is cheap, and it's something that, you know, you just ought to get as much as you can, because it's certainly worth it.
Interesting.
Yeah. I haven't really done much boating since I've moved down here from PA, which is ironic that I did more boating in Pennsylvania, which is landlocked, than I do down here. But
did you go to lakes and whatnot out there, or where would you go?
Susquehanna River. Yep. Mm-hmm. It was primarily the boating area. But up there, if you were under the age of 40, you had to have a boating license. So you actually had to go to school to get your boating license.
I could just turn 40 and be like, all right. Yeah.
So if you were 40 at the time when they put the law in place, you got grandfathered out of it if you were yeah. under 40. And then, yeah, you had to.
That is.
Yeah. But you could also be as young as you wanted to get your boating license, though. Like, I remember, I remember I was doing it with my sister, and she was like 11 or something at the time. She was super young. And I'm like, even with a license, I'm not sure if I trust you driving a boat. Probably can't see over the bow.
Nah. I mean, I think the idea of showing some kind of competency test, or at least right. understanding kind of the rules of the road type stuff, I think that's probably a pretty good idea.
Yeah, for sure.
It's, you know, it's tough out there.
Mm-hmm.
Especially we got, you know, down here, you got the weekend warriors come in from Raleigh. Right.
Yep.
They're out there, you know, it'd be nice, you know, if they had some kind of testing or something.
But, exactly. Yeah.
That intercoastal is so ridiculous some days.
Yeah.
And like, you have so many different types of boats too. Like, you'll have a speedboat coming up on you, and then you have another guy who's just getting a little pontoon, just kind of like putting along, and
And you got me over here on a paddleboard, just like, please don't drown
yeah.
me.
Yeah, yeah, true.
So, since you've been doing this for pushing, your current practice has been 10 years, right?
It has.
Is there like an interesting story you can tell us?
Well, I guess, there's certainly been a lot of interesting cases.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't really want to go on talking like the specifics of you of know, course. Stuff oh, yeah, that, no, that no. have gone down. But I mean, I think, you know, I would say about it, every day tends to be a new day. You know, you do have, as far as the cases that happen, you know, there's certainly some interesting things that you come across, you know, kind of in that boat sphere. Like, I never realized how common it was for people to fill up fishing rod holders. The people mistaken thinking that's where they're filling up gas.
Oh,
so, you know, that was kind of crazy. You know, it was, you know, seeing that, and, you know, it was really a bad situation what ended up happening with that. But, you know, there's been some fun cases to be involved with. I don't know if y'all remember when the Bald Head Island ferry ran aground.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of an interesting one.
Yeah.
And just kind of learning about that whole situation. Cause it just, you know, you might think of, you know, it being as simple as a situation like a parent let their kid use the boat and he ran aground. Well, this one was a little bit different. You had, you know, some implications with Southport. You know, they were complaining that the ferry was going too close to their shore, and they were blaming some of their erosion on the Bald Head ferry, and, you know, and you had ferry schedules and going in and out of the channel. And there was a lot more to it than just Junior took the boat out and messed up. You know, so those things were pretty cool doing that.
So I've always wondered this. When you go to court and argue something for, against, whatever it is, do you just do a ton of research behind it and be like, okay, this is why this guy should get off, or he should be charged with it? I never actually understood like how that worked.
There's two different things. There's two different audiences you have when you're arguing in court. You've got the judge or the jury. Mm-hmm. And so different types of arguments have different issues. So if you're arguing to a judge, you're arguing a legal issue. And so that's when you're going to want to do your research on case. And that can be kind of, you're typically dealing with statutes or cases.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing your legal research and saying, well, this incident's like this time where this happened, and here's what the court did. And so you're kind of using case study example. Mm-hmm. You're doing that. If you're doing a jury argument, you're essentially asking the jury to make a factual finding, like he did it or he didn't do it or what he did was negligent. And so you're not necessarily doing legal research when you do that. You want to be familiar with the facts and you want to think about how am I presenting this? You know, you want it to be persuasive and you kind of want it to appeal to the jury's sense of what probably happened. How am I going to explain that to them? What's going to make them see it our way? So it's kind of, they're both involve preparation, but it's two different kinds depending on who you're, what you're doing.
On the jury side, is this like just TV stuff or they talk about like jury, like psychology, like the, what was the old show? Bull.
Yeah.
Where they, is that something real that people actually go through? Or? Yeah.
So there's this series of books that came out, like it's called the Reptilian Mind.
Okay.
Is what it was talking about. And what it's about is, you know, for a while there was a strong public sentiment against personal injury cases, you know, and they tend to go in ebbs and flows. Like for a while people were kind of saying, oh, this guy's faking or it's a money grab or that sort of thing. And then this guy kind of came out. There was a lot of juror psychology that went into it. And the central idea behind it is appealing to the jurors kind of in, you know, appealing to what concerns them. And this might happen to you,
right?
Type thing. And so it's your job as a citizen to stand against rule breakers and people that run the red lights or the people. This isn't about the client trying to shake somebody down for money or faking or exaggerating. Right. This is about upholding order. And, you know, you might be the next one getting T-boned or that sort of thing. So that's, I would say that kind of the tables have turned a little bit right now towards kind of the plaintiff side a little bit, as far as how jurors are reacting to cases and verdicts that they're giving. And I think a lot of that has to do with kind of juror psychology.
Right.
So I'd say ultimately, I think a lot of times what a lot of these cases are is morality plays.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's what they're, so whereas in the past, the morality play, kind of the perception was, oh, this person already got paid by their insurance company and now they're trying to double dip and get a double recovery on their medical bills and they're saying their back hurts, but everybody's back hurts and that sort of thing. They've kind of turned it around a little bit by using juror psychology. I think it's kind of an interesting thing.
It is very interesting. This is something I've always wanted to ask an attorney. So like when it comes to, this was something that, I feel he just got sentenced like for forever, but he was the one who did the parade where he like ran through a bunch of people. This was up in like Wisconsin or somewhere.
I was going to say, which one?
Yeah,
unfortunately, that's kind of a common thing.
Yeah. There was one who was like really crazy and he decided to represent himself. Basically what his one and only defense was, and the judge told him not to do it, but he still did it and then got in trouble, was like jury nullification. Yep. Is that something that like you see in practice, or is that something crazy that this guy decided to do like as a Hail Mary throw?
I think jury nullification. Yeah. I think that's the goal of what a lot of people are doing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be, you just got to have to be careful with how you do it. Because I think what, when I hear jury nullification, what I'm thinking is I want the jury to side a certain way because of an, you know, I want to bring up an issue or put something before them that'll make them kind of disregard the obvious choice or the more likely choice to go over to this other side because they are convinced this one thing upsets them or persuades them or, you know, and it could be a lot of different things. It could be, you know, it could be the fact that they've embellished an injury. Like, you know, like a lot of times you'll have people hire private investigators, follow around personal injury claimants because they want to catch them on camera that one time that they said they couldn't mow the yard or they said they couldn't do that. Right. Then there you go. You got them on camera. Like, oh, he's a liar. And so where it might be that the evidence is that person did sustain an injury and they are hurt. In that situation, if I've got them on film doing the thing they can't say, I might want to make a attempted jury nullification by saying, look, that guy's a liar. We've got visual confirmation that he or she can't do the thing that they claim they could do. So if we know this thing's not true, how can the rest of it be trusted?
Oh yeah.
Type thing. So, and I mean, and I think there's certain things where jury nullification, like where it can be bad, you know, and where, you know, a judge is going to strictly prohibit it is, and maybe what that guy was doing right. is he maybe if they're trying to make it political or mm-hmm. where if they're saying, you know, that, and I don't know what, I can't imagine anybody that politically support, you know, running into a parade, right. but I mean, it might, you know, he might, if he's trying to argue that.
Well, what his thing was, he was, like I said, he was representing himself. So he had no clue what he was actually doing. And his one and only argument that he could possibly do was jury nullification. And he was like, hey, you do have a right. You see, you saw me do this. I'm guilty as charged, but you can say no.
Well, yeah. Yeah. And I think where people, you know, because especially in criminal, but, you know, in North Carolina, criminal and civil, the verdict has to be unanimous.
Right.
So, you know, if you're in that situation, maybe what you're thinking is, I only need one. Mm-hmm. And if I can get one person to say, yeah, I want to be able to run over somebody, you know, because, right. you know, I should be able to, you know, like, I, you know, if I just do this one thing, it's going to mess everything up. Right. And that's, I guess, you know, when you're caught dead in the rights, you know, that's what he tried to do. I don't know. But,
right.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately, the decision the jury's making is not, are we convicting or are we putting him in jail or not putting him in jail or awarding money versus not, where it's they're asked to determine whether a set of facts happen.
Right.
And that's probably why the judge said, no, you're not allowed to do it. Cause it's like, no, the question is whether the guy ran over the parade. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not whether he should go to jail or not. It's did this thing happen?
Right.
And that's why it's, you know, it's irrelevant what, you know, to say, well, you know,
yeah,
let me off. Good point. Let me off. You can do it too.
Right.
People are so ridiculous. Oh, sorry. I'm just the silly things.
Yeah.
People, they're like, I can sue for this or I should be able to get out of that. It's ridiculous.
Have either y'all been on jury duty?
I was called for jury duty, but I didn't have to sit for it. They chose, it was for a federal one too. It was pretty big because I didn't realize what was going on. I'm like, what's happening? Why is this such a big deal? And then they went through it all and I was like, oh shoot. Okay.
The federal stuff's nice. Cause that's what I've been called for that before. And I didn't have to go because it was like, you call the number the night before and
right.
I was like, you're not needed.
Yes. I was going to ask about that. I'm like, do they still call lawyers to jury duty?
They do. Mm-hmm. And you don't get out of it just because you're an attorney. And you have to go through the same process as everybody else. Now, you're more likely to get cut as an attorney because they don't want, you know, the jury to try to, or the attorney to go in the jury room and say, this is how this works. This is what, you know, this is what's going on. So you're more likely than not to get excluded. But yeah, you still go.
The one that I went to, it was in Brunswick County. I live in Leland. And over there, they made everyone show up. They filled up a whole courtroom and they did voir dire with everyone in the courtroom. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's crazy. I didn't know this actually. So like, I found that fascinating.
And they get into your personal information.
Yeah.
You know, in there. And that's what I think is kind of, it's, and the judge has discretion on that. So you'll see like in federal court, like the judge will just say like, what's your name? Do you have a family? Where do you work? That's it.
Yeah.
Now, what you probably saw down in Brunswick County was, you know, they're asking, you know, how about your family and how do you feel about this? And, you know, it's a lot different, but it's all within the judge's discretion. But it's.
The judge let quite a bit of it go. There was only one time they told us to leave the jury room while it was going live. And it was because the case that they were doing voir dire for was a minor who was sexually assaulted. And so there was someone who quite evidently was sexually assaulted as a minor. And when they were doing voir dire for her, they kicked us all out of the room during that. But other than that, they let everyone up there. And it was heavy just watching the voir dire for it. So I couldn't even imagine the jury that had to sit through the 2 weeks that they did the whole trial. Yeah, super heavy.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, please don't call out. Please don't call out. Like, I don't want to do this one. And I've always wanted to sit on jury duty because I think the whole process is fascinating. I was like, okay, not this one.
No.
You mean you just want to sit and get paid to be in the air conditioning and judge people?
I just like the 35 cents a day you get paid or whatever the minimum is.
You
like,
get $12.
Oh, $12 a day. That's
right. It's over minimum wage.
It's a day, not
for
an
a
hour.
Day. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. No, it's, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're
looking, not enough for a lunch.
You're about $1.50 an hour.
Right.
Is what you're looking at to do that. So
it's your civil duty.
Yeah. You know, one of the first, so I got obsessed with the OJ trial when I was a kid.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
And that was one of the things that really kind of like, when I went to law school, I thought I was going to be a criminal defense guy. Mm-hmm. And I was really into it. And so I read a bunch of the books that the lawyers wrote that were involved in the OJ trial. And one of them was Robert Shapiro's book. I think his book was probably the best out of all the people that wrote books about it. And what I thought was interesting is the way he closed the way he opened the book was with a portion from the California State Code of Ethics about how it's your duty to defend somebody even if you think they're guilty. Mm-hmm. And I was like, all right, well, I'll get what he's saying here. And then he closed it with, you know, a lot of his friends and people would give him a hard time. How could you be a part of this? And you know, this is terrible what happened. And he was like, well, the people that did that are the same people that would get a jury summons and call him, and be like, hey, can you help me get out of this?
Yeah.
And his point was kind of almost like a voting point. Is he's like, man, he's like, people need to get involved and serve their jury duty.
Yeah.
Because you can't. It's kind of like election. You can't complain if you don't vote. He's saying like, don't complain about the trials and then or the what happens in the court system and then try to cut out a jury duty every time you get right. appointed.
That actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I've always been really interested in that type of stuff. So I've always been wanting to be on jury duty and go through the process and kind of see what goes on. Not necessarily to be the judge of people, but just yeah. like, yeah. I love watching, like, even when I'm at work, I'll have like YouTube up watching like live criminal trials that they actually in this like few states that allow it. Which is interesting to me.
I was just quoting The Office, but
yeah.
Oh, so I'm assuming I'm looking at how much you've drank out of this Jameson bottle. Is this your favorite or is it one of your favorites?
I'd say it's one of them. You know, I kind of ended up getting a large whiskey collection and it was a lot of times just like people would, you know, from birthdays and stuff, people would get me whiskey or, you know, it's like, oh, they must think I'm a drunk. It's like, that's what I get. Or people come to the house. Cause I really don't even drink at the house hardly ever.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I was thinking as far as what do I drink regularly? Not really all that. I mean, when I go out, I obviously do, but I would say, yeah, I mean, I like Jameson. I like Macallan's. I like, those are probably my kind of everyday go-to type stuff. Yeah. I went on a conference to Louisville a year or two ago, went on the Bourbon Trail and kind of nice. Picked up yeah. a bunch of stuff there, but I hadn't, you know, it's just sitting around cause I typically don't sit around at the house and drink. I mean, I probably should, but since it's around, but I don't know. I do enjoy the Jameson.
I asked that cause I'm like, I really kind of want to try some more.
Yeah,
but I can't because we drank too much last night.
Right. Gotcha.
Yeah. So and like, we have another one after this. Yes. Nice.
Like, oh, that looks gotcha. So. It was actually like one of my favorites. That
I was we've gonna had say this is probably definitely like a top five or so. Yeah, yeah. That was very good.
Well, here, I'll leave it.
I will say you can. There's a difference when based on what you drink the whiskey out of. Also, yep. Like earlier we had it out of like
a wine glass,
and then we have some of the fancy bottles. The Glencairns.
Glencairns. Mm-hmm.
And then these, like our Whiskey and Wisdom glasses are like a big open rim. So you can, like you can put an ice cube in it, which you get to take this glass home.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Please do. But flavor wise, like you smell more, you taste more different things. And today's one of those days where I'm like, I wish I could drink more to enjoy it. And my body is like, Chris, you can't drink anymore.
There's always tomorrow.
Exactly. Yep.
Very true. I do work tomorrow, but you know.
After work, nightcap.
Huh.
Well, true thing. Always think. So you said that you're always interested in going into like criminal law. So what made you go into more of like the civil side?
Well, I think seeing what the attorneys do on a day in, day out basis. Mm-hmm. So my favorite part of being an attorney kind of from law school and then kind of still today, what I really enjoy is the legal research.
Yeah.
Kind of like seeing how cases in the past were handled, taking a look at, you know, trying to find the most analogous situation. And that's more times than not what you deal with in kind of the civil areas. Mm. A lot of times the criminal attorneys or the criminal practice, a lot of times it's, you know, I would say a majority of the people that commit crimes, a lot of times can't afford representation. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times what you would see is, you know, sometimes you're getting court appointed stuff and, you know, and then you've got a lot of times you'll have your client suing you or making bar complaints, but it was, they didn't pick you. You know, it's, you see a lot of that and you see kind of, so what I was thinking when I was younger is like, oh, I'm going to be Johnny Cochran or Robert Shapiro, or there are these guys and I'm going to have these high profile cases. And it's like, what you're hired most of the time for is like DUIs and drug tickets. And that's kind of the majority of what happens. And so I think that's what, and you know, and there's obviously tons of exceptions to those rules, but I didn't want to kind of get involved. What I enjoyed doing was doing research into kind of unique legal situations. Yeah. And a lot of times what I found is the practice of criminal law was a little bit different. It was more kind of being quick on your feet, kind of poking holes in cases. And, you know, there it was just a little bit, the practice was a little bit different than what I thought. So
yeah.
I think I'm better suited for civil stuff, but I mean, I've kind of dabbled in criminal things every once in a while, but as far as typically, that's just like if I'm representing my buddies or you know, my criminal buddies, and it's usually speeding tickets,
right?
And,
yeah,
and
yeah,
like
yeah,
so not like B&E's or anything. Right. I don't have my buddies doing that or anything like that. But so yeah, I've you know done very little criminal stuff. But
We had another attorney on who she does estate and business contracts. And it was a very similar story too, where like she went to law school, like I'm going to be this big, like criminal attorney. And then like you start actually looking into what does this actually look like? And she was like, I'm not sure if that's the route I want to go right now.
And that's common. I think more and more, like what I think when I was in school, I guess, which was 2004 to 2007, it seemed like a lot of us were talking about, I can't wait to get out and take the bar and I'm going to try this kind of case, or I'm going to do this and that. And a lot of the younger folks that I meet, they don't have any interest in that. They prefer, a lot of them prefer the transactional side, you know, might be business contracts, estates, wills.
Right.
So it's kind of the guys that like going into court and arguing that sort of thing are kind of becoming a rare breed right now.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Never thought about that.
Yeah.
I don't know why it is. I don't know.
So one of my last questions for you is, with your practice and life in general, like what would success look like for you?
Well, I would say winning. And what I mean by that is I kind of view success as an adjective. Mm-hmm. Like I don't think you can become a success. You know, because it's, you know, if you're basing kind of how you would describe yourself off what you've done in the past, you're looking backwards.
Right.
And so when I think of what a success looks like, it's accomplishing your objectives, you know, and it can be anywhere from, you know, getting up and making it into work on time to helping teach some, you know, a junior attorney or a paralegal helping teach them to winning a big case. That would be a success. But I think, to me, it's kind of being capable and accomplishing your objectives is what I, and that's what I meant by a win. Yeah. It would be like doing the task in front of you and prevailing. Yeah. Is kind of what I would say success looks like, in my opinion.
Nice. So with that being said, so one of my last questions for you is, if you were to tell your younger self one thing, what would it be?
I would say probably to kind of follow your dreams type thing, because I think when I was a kid, I saw things really black and white and kind of thought I had it figured out. And so a lot of times, like, for example, you know, I studied business information systems in college because I thought, you know, I wanted to have a fall. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer, but I was like, I want to have a fallback in case I don't get in, you know, and computer jobs make money, but I wasn't good at computers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't do what I was good at, but because I thought I had it figured out, well, this is what the starting salary of a computer engineer is more than, you know what I mean? But I think what's most important is if you like what you're doing and you have an aptitude for it, you're more likely to to excel. You know, I kind of viewed things as, you know, if I get a 98 on the test rather than a 95, you know, I'm going to get a better job and I'm going to, you know, and I'm going to enjoy the job and that sort of thing, and kind of very formulaic. But I guess what I would have told myself is, hey, just, you know, really pursue the things that you enjoy and that you feel like you've got a chance to excel. And, you know, don't worry about kind of the more common path or what might seem like it makes sense at the time. Because I didn't really have enough experience to really know, you know, but I thought I had it kind of figured out. But
yeah, that's great. I love that. I have actually one last question before I lied. Sorry. I just thought about this. So I'm in the financial services industry, and I know with what I do, it seems like laws are changing every year when it comes to what we have to do and how we can practice and everything too. Is that something that happens in the law side as well? Is there always something changing in North Carolina, or is it pretty standard?
Yeah, you're always a vote or a court decision away from a law changing. So we have continuing education requirements. And so, yeah, you know, but part of it is, you know, when you're researching your case, you're always checking to see, is there something new that I need to be aware of? But then also, a lot of times we're getting case law updates or legislative updates in our continuing ed. So yeah, it's similar. I can't imagine being a tax lawyer.
Right.
Like, tax lawyers, it's changing like every year. There's new regs, new laws, new interpretations. I mean, the stuff, you know, the real estate laws in North Carolina and admiralty laws have pretty much been the same for 200 years, you know, for the most part. I mean, there's definitely some minor changes that happen, but for the core concepts are the same. But, you know, with taxes and finance, you know, those sort of things. It's always evolving.
Since like 2020, before then, like all of the numbers generally stayed relatively similar. But since 2020, it feels like every single year, it's like, okay, now these numbers changed. And now if you make this much, you're excluded. But if you make this little, now you're included. And now your IRA can go up to this much. And now you can take 529s and roll them into Roth IRAs. And you're like, what is going on? And it's like within 3 years. And you're like, oh my goodness. It's like a whole nother like finance education going on here. Yeah. So I was just wondering if it was like a similar thing, like along with the votes.
Not to that extent, but yes. Yeah. Yes. There's always new stuff. And I mean, it makes it challenging, but it's part of the fun of it too.
Right. Yeah. That's why I enjoy doing what I do. Cause it's always something new to learn and always like just always progressing forward.
I agree.
Awesome. I like it.
So where can people find you to use your services?
All right. So our website is called humphreysfirm.law. So that's a lot. And I know I've got kind of a Southern accent, so dot law. So it's a period L-A-W, but humphreysfirm.law. And then we're also on Instagram at the Humphreys Law Firm, and Facebook, you know, looks up Humphreys Law Firm and see some of the content that I'm not involved in a lot of it, but a lot of the folks at the office do a good job putting that together. Awesome. And so, yeah.
Nice.
Very good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
I learned a lot.
Yeah. This hour flew by. I looked down and I was like, we're already past 50 minutes. Oh my goodness. So that's always a good problem to have though. Sure. So, which means we'll also have to have you on sometime soon
too. Oh, I love coming on. I miss having the podcast and the stuff we used to do.
Yeah, that's great. Well, thank you so much again and cheers.
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 Oh, a second drink, all my. <That's good. laughs>